Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 252. My conversation with theater artist and podcaster, Paul Dykeman. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Audible is available on your phone, you guys. Yeah, that thing in your hand right now? Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to download the app and sign up to get your free audiobook today. It's easy. Our other sponsor is my company, PodcastCadet.com. My husband Chris and I run the company, PodcastCadet.com. We provide advice and production help to any podcaster who needs it. We can give you a little push or we can help you with the production of all your podcast episodes. Contact us now at podcastcadet.com and use code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, we talk to Paul Dykeman, performer, producer, and podcaster from the Philadelphia area. Our chat goes deep into improv theory. So many fun rabbit holes. In our conversation, we talk about Paul's voracious appetite for learning all things theatrical. We chat about team building, dramaturgy, and Zoom workshops. This episode is a great exploration of living a life in the arts. Support Paul Dykeman by listening to his improv podcast, The Offer. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 252. Paul Dykeman talks about making connections and telling stories. Enjoy. Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
Yes, I'm going to try and use that in my next episode. I'm going to try and find a place to use that as a scene edit because that's great.
I hope you can remember such a thing. I have such I have such improv brain that it's gone seconds. That's why at the end of these episodes, I think we talked about different things because my brain is just still teeming with new ideas. So it's the 20 ideas after we hang up that I that are stuck in my head. And then I'm like, no, wait, these notes here say that you talked about cats. What's going on? You know,
totally. But I think there's something to that hopefully I can get around to talking about when we're recording as well. Cause there's a meditative quality to it, I guess.
Tell me what you're talking about.
Oh, well, you were just saying about improv brain, right?
Tell me about your improv brain. I have a terrible, etch-a-sketch of a brain.
Yeah, well, I do too. But I think I go to improv specifically because it forces me to focus so purely on what's happening because I can only grab what's happening right then, and how I'm reacting to it. And in that way, it is a form of meditation, right? Mm-hmm. Because it takes all these other thoughts and sort of sublimates them into a different mantra, which the mantra in this case can be quite chaotic. There's all these different things going on to keep track of. But it is this extraordinary focus and presence that I always finish feeling better than I started. Usually just sort of when I say better, I mean sort of in a full bodied way. And this is one of the things that keeps bringing me back to improv is this sort of meditative quality, even though it's quite chaotic. Because I struggle to sit quietly and meditate. I just have too many things happening. Mm-hmm. But I can play with a friend straight for an hour and then finish and be like, wow, what? All those things happened. That was incredible. And feel sort of more relieved and relaxed in the way that people describe meditation, bringing them into this other state of being. I don't know, is that how improv feels for you? Do you finish it feeling like, I mean, you seem to describe feeling like sort of electrified. Maybe that's not quite the thing I mean. I don't know. Yeah, resonate with you at all?
Yeah, I like that a lot. What you were saying made me think of how some people say extroverts get energy from people and introverts, their energy is sucked out by people. So I wonder if I certainly feel this way. It sounds like you feel this way, or an extroverted performer, so that when you do performing, instead of you being drained by the event of performing, it instead like infuses you with more energy. And that definitely happens to me. I could show up to the theater like yawning and like, does anybody have a Red Bull? Oh my God. And by the end of the show, I'm all like, what's up? Like, it's very, yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Energy. There's this way that this like synergy where the sort of like 1 + 1 = 3 of people in the space, because as you sort of bounce the ideas back and forth, or maybe it's an extroverted thing. I think of myself as often quite introverted, but I agree. I have the same result that like when I'm in a space with people, which again is not something that's happened in a while, but there are ways to get close to approximate some of that online. And I feel I've gotten pretty good at doing that. And I do sort of finish more excited. And I think even just now, because it's late where I am. It's later where I am than where you are. I was feeling a little sleepy. Now that we've been chatting for a bit, I'm a little bit more animated.
Yeah.
And I think there is just this part of me that responds to another person when I'm really listening to them and when they're listening to me, that all these things sort of turn on and focus and I feel awake and alive. So I guess perhaps that is about extroversion. That, yeah, we seem to like give each other energy and it equates to more than where we started, which is quite magical.
I think that it's totally valid to be both an extroverted performer and maybe like an introverted, like at home person, because like, you know, you can be multiple things. There's this thing that they keep telling us. We were talking earlier about, ideas to debunk. Well, here's an idea to debunk. The idea that we have to just be one thing. Oh, I'm an extrovert. That's it. All the time. Nope. Pretty sure you can ebb and flow in that, not only like during the course of your life, which is many, many years, but also like different circumstances, right? Like if you feel comfortable, like in improv, the whole idea that you're creating with you and your teammates is like this comfort, this like openness, this like trust, so that when you go out there, even if you're feeling like, I don't know what I can do, your friends are there for you, right? They're not there to make themselves look good. They're there to make everyone look good and to make you look good. So you can like just be there in that moment, and having that like, you know, warm hug of an environment can really allow you to be an extrovert. Whereas perhaps if you were involved in like a play where everybody was really like backstabby and everyone kept being like, oh, hey, Paul, I guess your hair is okay. And every time you saw them, you'd be like, oh, hey, like. And then you don't feel as strongly that you can like emote in the show, and like it's not quite as, you know, you're going to be a little bit more like, I'll just stay in my dressing room, because the environment is not that. So I think there's a lot of factors, and I think that, you know, a lot of us try to make ourselves fit into one box or another, when I think like, you know, we're kind of in an amorphous blob that like kind of spills out of the box and like drips on the counter, and it's okay.
Yeah, we are not like solid shapes. We are gaseous. We sort of fill the space we're given, or whatever sort of support we receive, we expand to fill that space, and we shrink when we don't have that and hide. Yeah, totally. I think that's really insightful to point out that it is sort of about the environment and the support. And it's interesting to try to make. To try to structure spaces so that they are supportive that way, even if it's a classroom or even if it's a professional production, right? How do you, even if everyone's being paid, even if it's just like, I don't know, jobs where I've worked, like making sandwiches, how do you create spaces that are that supportive all the time? Because it does feel really good on the improv stage when everyone's really supportive, right? When everyone is helping each other accomplish things and they're there for one another. There's something so incredibly good about that. And I would like to figure out ways to be more like that in those moments where I'm like, oh, I don't feel a lot of support, or this space isn't very supportive. I would love to be able to learn to transform spaces more into sort of radically supportive ones, or maybe that would, I don't know, destabilize society. I don't know, but there's something about it that's really delightful. So
yeah, I totally agree with you. There's what you're talking about made me think of a job that I had in my life. Like a regular job. Like I worked front desk at a hotel in New York City when I lived there.
How cool.
And it was great. And it was like a hotel. So I'm in the front desk, and the whole front lobby is just a glass wall, right? So I'm just on the corner of 39th and 7th, like just looking out at the world, like great, so fun. But the reason why this work was so supportive and together was that we opened the hotel together. Right. So the hotel itself was a brand new building and they hired people in New York. Hotels are a union job. But when they're open a brand new hotel, you don't have to have a union staff. Right. So they just called for everybody. So anyone that had ever worked at a hotel in anywhere USA that wasn't New York came and got a job there. And it was great because all of us had been trying. I went to college in Dallas. And so I worked in hotels in Dallas for a while. Hotels are a great job. And, when I moved to New York, I was like, oh, yeah, I can work in hotels. But then I had the union thing, whatever. Anyway, I get this job. They're like, yeah, you can work here. It was so great. They're like, we're not going to open for 2 weeks. I'm like, okay. And they're like, no, you have to come in every day, 5 days a week. We're going to set up the whole hotel together. It was like, what? So the whole building had been built, right? All of the beds were put into the room and it was a long-term stay hotel. So like the kitchens were put in and the laundry stuff was all set up. We just had to put in like the coffee maker and the love seats and the pillows and the everything. So it was me and like 100 other people. And the best part is, so it's just being built. They're still doing some construction stuff. The elevators don't work. It's 20 stories high. So 100 of us are on the stairs, passing one by one, passing coffee machines up the stairs, trying to like every room on every floor filled with a coffee. Okay, coffees are done. We're going pillows. Oh, cool. Pillows. And we just like passed everything around. And then once everything was divided up into the rooms, we divided into our departments. And then we did individual learning, you know, like front desk was like the programs and how to be nice to people. And the cleaning people were like, this is how you clean. And then the maintenance people were like, this is how you fix stuff. So they went off in their own groups, but then at lunch we'd all come back together to have like pizza and like a team building chat. And I really feel like those 2 weeks really like bonded us so intensely that, you know, after that I just had the best time working there. I mean, it was just like so wonderful. Everyone had your back. Like there was never like, you know, when you needed to like switch shifts, it wasn't like, oh my god, I want to switch shifts with you. It was all like, sure, yeah, let's do it. Like we had fun. We were like enjoying ourselves. People could tell that we're like checking in. They were like, wow, everyone seems so happy. And we were like, we are, you know, like it was just such a good thing. And I worked there for 3 or 4 years. So maybe after the first year, it started, the feeling of camaraderie deteriorated a little bit because people had moved on and the managers were different and different things had changed. And so the vibe of what happened was different. But for a little while, we really had this like perfectly running machine that was built out of like 2 weeks of like camp that we spent together and got paid for, and it was great, and we had pizza like every day, and we lived in New York eating pizza. Like it was great. It was like, you know, I don't know. So I think it can happen. You just kind of have to put in the team building and the like, you know, bonding for it to really work out.
Yeah, totally. I you're making me think of, there's this interesting way that what you're describing was like sort of organic, because it was just like, we just have to do this, right? Like we just need everyone to do these ridiculous tasks. Like you're gonna hand 1,000 pillows up the stairs because like that's what we have to do. Yeah. But there is something incredibly unifying about that sort of collective, I don't want to say that it was like a little bit ridiculous, this sort of just like collective necessity, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like I'm thinking of some like really crazy things. The last 2 years I worked at a high school, middle school in Shanghai in China. And they have this huge diverse staff of people from all over the place, lots of different countries, very different departments. So they would try to, and there was no like single time they would all show up in one place. Cause it was like, oh, we hired 10 new teachers. Those 10 new teachers met each other, but then you go to your separate places and there's all these other people, you know? So they would try a couple times a year to have these like team building interesting things where they would randomly assign people to teams and then have them compete in like various games. And we would do things like we would all have to like carry big rubber ducks, or we would all have to like lift logs together and move them like rubber, like, I don't know, like these weird foam. It all felt very dystopic, but like we were like trying to do things together while they took pictures of us. And instead of like bonding us, it really only bonded us in sort of a hatred of the management. Like we only sort of disliked, we only came to be like, we don't know why we're doing this. I don't know who any of you are. And we don't want to give up this day that's supposed to be a day off to like carry a big rubber duck. So like there's this interesting way that your story highlights the way it can work really well when it isn't sort of, when it is genuine in sort of its place of like, we just need to do these things and you're all going to get to know each other. And there's like sort of a story of like, this place is just starting. And then this other thing that like almost out of the gate feels manipulative, which was, you know, my version of like, we're all wearing red jerseys versus the green jerseys, yeah, playing touch football or whatever. And it somehow didn't accomplish the thing that like made us feel together. But I do remember thinking in the moment is like, should I just be like really gung ho and into this and I could change the tone of it? And I don't know that that's the case. Like I wonder how much of it is there. Like I would like to believe as an improviser, like I, as one person, could just yes and the situation and it's going to be better. But it does sort of feel like thinking back to that moment that I don't know that I could have done anything to like make it. I mean, I could have had more fun by sort of just playing my way through it, but I don't know if it could have succeeded in the way that your story would have had fun, like brought people together. So it's just interesting to consider like why that worked and why this, like a couple of, and I've had a couple of different companies try things like this that are just like not, that don't work. I don't know.
Two thoughts on your story. One, are you sure you weren't on some sort of like television show? Because I feel like there's a lot of Chinese videos where people are made to carry oversized things and then they're like, look at this guy. Were there cameras? Just asking, you know, just, was there an audience? Well,
there was not an audience, but it was definitely all heavily photographed, mm-hmm, for the purpose of like, because this school was not like a public school. It's like a private school. So they're like pitching to the parents, like, look at how engaged and look at all the camaraderie of our teachers or whatever. So it was propaganda for sure. And like there would be like a viral video of people dancing to a certain thing. And then all of a sudden it would be like, everyone, we are now going to have to learn this dance and do it together on this field. And we were like, what? Why? And they're like, because it will show that there's unity. Good, do it. And we were like, why? We're what? But so it was definitely outward facing and propagandized. I don't think it was actually but the thing about it is I would never know, because there was just there's a way that I could never have access to certain media. Like certain things are just like unsearchable unless you sort of are highly proficient in Chinese to be able to find such
things. There's also some cultural stuff I'm sure that we just don't get. Like there's just no way we would understand, oh, this is what this means. Because the other thing I was going to say about it was the one thing that perhaps they were thinking was that negative stimuli actually does bond people better than positive.
Really?
Like fun times. It does. If you go through something really difficult with people, you tend to be like more bonded with them, you know, because you've just like made it through something nice happens and you guys have a good time. But it's like receiving an insult versus receiving a compliment. Like your brain holds that insult for months, days, years, whereas somebody gives you like six compliments and you're like, what did she say? I didn't even hear it. It was like, are you kidding me? She just told you the best thing in the world. And you were like, all I heard was, I don't like your earrings, and now I'm done, you know, like that's,
yeah.
So it's, I feel like that maybe they're trying really hard. They're reading this psychology book. It says negative stimuli. And then they're like, let's do it. And then they're like, I don't know. These Americans just don't seem to be really vibing.
Doesn't seem to work.
And I don't know why. Man, Americans.
I would add like the slightest nuance to like bad things bonds you more. And I think it's like overcoming obstacles together bonds people together. So if it's like, if it's difficult, cause you like, we, I don't know, like I think of a neighborhood like shoveling snow just cause we recently got blanketed with a ton of snow. There's this really interesting opportunity. We're all out doing like this, like really sort of backbreaking work. And that sort of bonds us because like, we're just sort of like all doing something together that's kind of unpleasant. But when the thing that is holding you together, like when the management is the thing that becomes the target of that ire, they're also the ones who like set up all the spaces. It's not, you're not really overcoming an obstacle. You're just like checking off their boxes. You're like, there's no sense of like sort of we got over it to the other side. And that was maybe why it didn't like unify us in a healthy way. We definitely were unified in our hatred of it, but that hatred sort of bubbled over to other things going on in the space as well. So yeah, I think there's something to that, like the difficulty or problem bonds people, but I think it's actually the like, and together we get over it to like, we work through it together. Maybe. That's the space that creates the like, oh, we're a community now because we overcame that together.
I feel like the lesson you're espousing right now needs to be given to like the Veterans Affairs office. Like, it's like, hey, here's something. Maybe after that war where they were like all super negative stimuli all the time, maybe they you give them some positive stuff after a couple, you know, like beach days and, you know. Maybe, you know, some chocolate, little cotton candy. I don't know. Whatever they want to be happy. Just cut for a couple of months, maybe a couple of years. Just saying. You know,
swap whatever. In a bit of a carrot to alternate with the stick for sure.
Oh, yeah. So much stick. So little carrot.
That sounds like a Chinese proverb.
Totally.
So much stick. Not enough carrots.
It totally is. And that's what they were. That's the method they were using to teach you to bond. That's what it was.
Yeah. You are right to point out that there's like a big gulf of cultural difference that like, that it's hard to, there was often a sense of like, I don't quite know why, like in particular in relation to like the administration, I keep using the word management, but in schools they're known as an administration, like, but why the administration was doing something. And I would turn to someone who had been at the school for like 5 years. And I was like, why are we on this field wearing Tai Chi garments? Like, why are we in robes badly wandering our way through this thing that they made us rehearse and they're filming with a drone? And they were just like, I don't know, we just got to do it, like just keep going. I know none of us know what we're doing, just
keep going.
And so there was this interest, there's this interesting problem that it's really important to not just understand like what you have to do, because you can just like go through some motions and be like, why am I doing this? You have to have this other level of understanding about, or at least a perception that you can be accomplishing their intention. Like if the leader of something goes like, we're going to do this. If all it is a list of details, that doesn't sort of like satisfy something in us that helps us know, oh, this is why this is a good thing to do. This is what this person wants to accomplish. So now I can do exactly what I've done before, but with this very different attitude towards it. And that different attitude totally changes the result. The attitude isn't separable in my mind from the result, I guess.
Yeah.
But management will often go at it as if like, well, as long as they do the thing, we've done the team training, we've done the sensitivity training, we've done the whatever, it's done, let's move on. And it's like, well, only if everyone really understood why you thought it was important to do that. I think the flip side of that is a lot of people feel like, well, it's just a box. I just have to check it off that we did this training. We did this thing. There, it's done, which is not why the training needed to exist in the first place.
You know, to harken back to the improv that we were talking about earlier,
yeah.
I think that there is a certain kind of person who is seeking a, you know, deeper, larger meaning and is looking at the world for themes and patterns and stuff. And I find that, you know, that crowd tends to be involved in improv. Now, improv is sometimes filled with performers that want to be famous or want to be on stage or want to be, you know, in front of audiences. But a lot of times people are just taking improv to kind of like help them in their lives or help them in their jobs or whatnot. And I feel like it's like the people who are drawn to it are the people whose brains have that sort of like, they want more details. They need to build a larger picture. They need to connect ideas and whatnot, versus some people who like you say, you know, just want to tick a box or just like did it. And you're like, okay, but did you do, did you do it and really experience it? You know, like even you living in China, like why? How was that? Nice. But like, how do you, like, how did you get to China? Like, for real, well, at what point in your life were you like, here's a list of things I'd like to do. And then you went to China. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, they were definitely not it was definitely not on the list. It was a sort of series of, yeah, I got there. And it's not a place you sort of accidentally stroll up to. So it did require some intention on my part, but it was one of those things that was like a series of curveballs. So, to wind back the clock a little bit on it, I had sort of set my sights on, although I'm in improv and I'm teaching improv right now, I had been working in and noticing what it meant to be in the sort of small and not so small theater world in and around the Philadelphia area. And I was getting to like it. And I'd spent some time observing like regional theaters and small theaters that were doing established plays and doing new play development. And the thing that was like really getting me excited, I think because it was harkening back to where I'd started in improv, was devising and dramaturging devised work. And I found about this program that was through the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, through an alumni of that program who was living in Cambridge at that time. And it was a really cool dramaturgy program. And I set my sights on it. I applied, I moved there. I found some work, like just doing something to fill time while I was waiting to hopefully get into that. I sort of bet a lot on that working. And then that program just sort of ran afoul of some both international and national politics. And the program closed. And my friend, who was an alumni of the program and living in Cambridge, was looking at stuff to do, and she had applied to a gig in China teaching theater. So I applied as well. And then she got it and I got it, but then she got a much nicer gig in New Zealand, and she went and did that. And then I just was like, well, I guess that's the way I'm going. I guess I'll go there. And I ended up in China teaching for a little while, like creative writing and playwriting, and then eventually just theater. Yeah. So it was like an accident and required a lot of intention. But yeah, that's the like Cliff Notes run through of how exactly I ended up in the Middle Kingdom.
I appreciate the quick wrap up of how you got there. How did creative writing and playwriting and theater work in your classes with Chinese kids or adults?
They were kids. They were like high school and then some middle school kids. And I guess the thing that's interesting about the sort of work that I did is I wasn't for the first year I was doing playwriting, I was not in a school. I was in what's called a training center, which is sort of like a center for tutors. Right. So parents would sort of feel that their students were lacking in liberal arts skills. And this training center offered debate and theater and what they called like critical thinking. And so what that center needed when I went there was critical thinking, but I just sort of immediately started getting into playwriting because for me, it was the way to engage the students wherever they were. Because if I could get them engaged in sort of storytelling, I could get them asking questions about the best way to tell that story. And then I could get them thinking about stories that they would read or articles that they read about how those things communicated their messages. So for me, it was a clear, it was just the way that I applied the skills that I had in terms of, I like making stories, I like writing plays, and I could get students more excited about that. Then I could be like, let's examine this article and try to make so for me, it was always the creativity was a way to sort of like sneak in the critical thinking that was actually the goal of the center. And it just feeds me more to do story making and playmaking. And it went really well. And then the theater stuff was quite interesting because when I started, I came at it with this like, cool, we're going to be, I had all these ideas of like, Viola Spolin and Uta Hagen. We're going to do all these exercises. We're going to like develop sort of your core ability to express. But what, at least initially, I was told I had to make were like these, what I would describe as like very typical pat, like they really wanted like 15 minute pageants for all the different classes. They wanted like things that they could do that the students could like have pre-recorded, that it would look good in photos. Everyone could hear it. Everyone would be happy. And the students hated doing it and I hated doing it. And so I very quickly started introducing elements of improv into what we were doing because it was just, it was what I knew. It was what was more comfortable. And I could trick the students into really engaging in it with like sprinkling in some theater sports here or some storytelling here. And before I knew it, I could like work on their sort of competitive impulses or give them an opportunity to express in a way that they haven't managed to express before. And so we did some theater sports presentations. I also sort of tapped into some, you know, the neo-futurists in New York and I think they're in Chicago and mm-hmm. LA as well. Yeah, like they do these short, like 2 minute play things that also sort of meshed with, I don't know, just a generation that works very quickly. They appreciate like very short content and creating stuff. And the neo-futurists are totally down for that too. So I sort of like, I was just noticing what woke the students up and made them most alive. And I was finding this interesting confluence of like playwriting and improvisation as a way to engage their creative faculties, I guess. And just looking at them as like people that needed to be sort of called out rather than like information force fed into them until they like spat lines back at me. Hmm. And the things I found that worked were improv or creative work that really brought them out.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I really love that you were able to weave what you knew how to do into this like critical thinking class. And nobody was like, hey, stop doing that.
Actually quite the opposite.
Oh.
When I like arranged a play reading, they were like, wow, that's amazing. Let's do more of that. But I mean, it took quite a lot of like try like sort of secreting my way through to get to that point. But when I had the students like read their plays at music stands and present their ideas and talk about them a bit, everyone loved it and was like, wow, that's amazing. Because it really tapped what they wanted to accomplish. They just had the wrong roadmap to get there.
Hmm.
And so it was very gratifying for them to be like, to be so impressed and love the result as soon as I had just trusted my own instinct as looking at their curriculum maps, being like, I don't think this is actually how this works. I don't think you're really paying attention to what this student needs. Trusting that impulse, just doing it. And again, relying on what I know, created great things and really helped the students, I think, a lot more than, there were all sorts of things that were very silly in terms of activities.
Now, may I ask you a question about your sort of theatrical education? You've mentioned about 4,000 different references from different styles of theater and whatnot. And yeah. like, you know, you don't get that. You don't get that a lot. And, you know, you're not getting to learn that at in some college program. Are you self-taught? Did you like investigate all these theater programs? Because you're like talking about improv, but you're talking about devised theater, which is different than theater sports. Mm-hmm. So that means there's mm-hmm. And then there's also Viola Spolin, which is a different kind of improv. And then you're bringing up neo-futurist, which is a theater thing. And then you're working in theater, like straight plays. So like tell me how you got all this information in your brain.
Yeah, well, thanks for, I wasn't intentionally trying to drop. I wasn't trying to be like, look at all those shiny bubbles. But
oh, no, I'm not so calling you out like, hey, man, stop bragging about how you know theater things. I'm like interested in all these different things. But I'm like, I could ask one question or I could ask 400 questions. So I'm going to go with this one.
The one is good.
Easier.
I agree. Well, so I'll tell the story of how I end up in this. A lot of it is like sort of me discovering an exercise I really like and following the thread back to its original teacher and being like, wow, I like this. Wow, this is interesting. This is a cool thought. And then recognizing that none of the disciplines, although they are like realized differently in the world, are all quite related. But to tell the whole story mm-hmm, from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I come into, I think, into the world of performance first in improv because in high school, I was just incredibly shy, middle school as well. I was just so afraid of being seen. But what happened was I was in some class with somebody in high school and they, I guess, desperately needed a male. Like they needed somebody for this play. They needed an ensemble male member. And so this really go-getter lead actress just like scoped somebody out who she's like, I can get this. I can, he will just do what I say. I can do this. And she pulled me in and essentially made the appeal in the sense of like, Paul, you like reading, right? You like Shakespeare. We're going to do this shake. We're doing the shakes. We're doing Twelfth Night. Come on. Like you just come after school.
Come on.
And I was like, oh, okay. I like books. So I like Shakespeare. Sure. And essentially the director's concept, my high school theater director's concept was like, we're going to do Twelfth Night, but there's not going to be any set. It's just going to be like Zani's in the background. He's a Commedia dell'arte guy who are going to like be all the benches and all the doors and all the walls and stuff. And like, that way we can make the play go faster. And also like you guys take care of any problems that show up, just sort of improvise, you know, make stuff happen while I do the scenes and stuff. And so like, I was just like thrown in. They needed a guy because they needed somebody who was going to be a bench so that the guys could sit on that bench. Like that was the need.
That's good.
But I was, because of like the fact that I did read a lot and I could like quickly comprehend what was happening, it was easier for me to play in the background and improvise, I guess, behind Twelfth Night, what was happening with us like cast of ragtag servants who had to do all this stuff in the background. And from there, I discovered this sort of like liberating freedom of just playing within that framework. And so I guess initially I'm introduced to Commedia and improv in the background of a straight play, right? So already right there, we've got like a bunch of different disciplines swimming around. I go on to do more and more improv with this group, and the improv that I did end up leading that high school improv group. They would meet once a week and just do a series of improv exercises that would pull from, I would say, a lot of from Johnstone stuff, like a lot of not necessarily theater sports, but a lot of like improv from Storyteller stuff, as well as just purely playing stuff we liked playing. That group would also write plays. We would do like 24-hour playwriting events, and we would do a student written theater production. So there I started getting into like playwriting and the way that improv could lead to playwriting, which is starting to head in the direction of like what devising is, right? Which is why I start to get interested in those things.
Were you inspired by your high school teacher? Like, was this person like,
totally,
hey, yeah, here's all the stuff. Hey, did you know that you could also do this? Because there's two ways that I've seen it happen, which is like, there's a teacher and they like tell people and they lead them, and that's great. And then some people are like, hey guys, I found this book in the library, want to read it as a group? And then like they all do improv because they read impro in like the back of the library. Both legitimate stories that I've heard from people. Like, so
yeah.
I just am like, tell me about this teacher. Like, is this teacher still working, you know, enriching high school students all around? Like, it's great that they were there for you.
Yeah, no. His name's Craig Tavani, and he was totally a big influence in terms of like pointing us at Johnstone, and also just doing a lot of like sort of Commedia dell'arte sort of physical theater work with us in terms of like what's the Zani's body look like, what's the pantalone, right? We're doing a lot of and mask work as well, because those are his interests. He's into sort of Commedia dell'arte and clown and improv, and definitely brought those things to the group and encourage us to explore in those directions. At the same time, what's sort of interesting, I guess, the sort of nuance of my story is I would say that he didn't go out of his way to encourage anyone into the arts. Like, he didn't really go like, yeah, like, do like, try to do this outside of this, because like, I think he maybe felt a little worried that we would try it and it would be not as fun in the professional world. Like, you know, we wouldn't live well afterwards or whatever. So he wasn't like a big like, yeah, like go study this, go. But he was super supportive of us creating things then, and introduced me to like those big names at first in terms of like Johnstone, and then Fava in terms of his work. And so with sort of that in mind, I started to find and just like read improv for storytellers. I don't think in high school I necessarily comprehended it very well. When I returned to improv for storytellers later, I started to understand it more and know how to like pick the exercises out of it to do. This is sort of the nuance of what it's like to read John Stone. Sometimes he's super clear and sometimes not so much.
I feel like that's the case with a lot of theater books, though. My college theater book was The Empty Space by Peter Brook. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I definitely mm-hmm. read it when I was 18, but I don't know what it was about back then. And then I read it maybe like 2 years ago and I was like, Oh, okay.
Oh, this is what this is. I had no idea
what we were doing, but now I'm like, oh, okay. Because it's kind of like from the perspective of somebody who's done a lot of theater. So I had to wait until I had been through a few of those versions of what he's talking about to be like, oh, I see what he means. Cause I was in that. Yeah. Okay. All right. You know what I mean? But when you're 18 and you're like, I've done Oklahoma, you guys, I'm amazing. Like it's not.
Oh, Oklahoma.
Right?
Yes, absolutely.
Seriously, that's all I knew about the South before I moved here.
Wow. That's a big curtain pulling
that's
back there.
Terrible. Anyway, oh, wow. So we're back to you. You're talking about how you got into mm-hmm. this new, you know, you're working on improv, you're working on devised theater. What happened after high school?
Yeah, so I wasn't necessarily encouraged by like my surroundings to like pursue, even though I think in high school I was also in the Boy Scouts and I like couldn't manage to want to build a gazebo or whatever for an Eagle Scout project. I was like, could I like do a show? But that like it just didn't quite jive with the aesthetics, right? So at some point in high school I was recognizing I'm more interested in this than other things. Like this is way more like creating theater together, whether it is like something I'm directing or an event that I'm organizing or making a play or improvising and playing games. This is where I'm most alive. However, I wouldn't say that as a kid, I even realized as in high school, I realized that that was a possibility to pursue. So I went to study like English. Like I was sort of like, I'll figure that out.
Sure.
And so I go to this school that doesn't have like a huge theater program, but I take everything that they have, like every single theater class they have, I am taking because I am missing something. The other thing that I then met, only at this point in my journey do I meet what I would call the like, there's this world of sort of college improv, like people that are just doing it for fun. I don't mean to disparage this at all,
but
people that are doing it for fun, and it is good fun, and they're doing comedy, right? They're really leaning into the comedy. They're like they're straight doing games from Whose Line Is It Anyway, which is not something I had like really learned about up to that point. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool, but it's not necessarily what I am A, that good at, or B, all that interested in right now. Not to like, just as I think it's just a sort of separate interest. And so that
You're
was the point
to
I started
like stuff. It's okay. I also am not into that as much. I don't do I don't do short form at all. It's okay.
Right. That's interesting. So what I've been thinking about it recently, even though I think it comes across that I'm saying I dislike it, I just think it's sort of like, it's just like different flavors, right? Some people are really into caramel and because I'm not into caramel, it doesn't mean that like caramel is inherently bad.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
So, or a different way of saying it is like, you know, if one scientist goes into like cryptography to break codes and another scientist goes into biology to understand different, they're just different disciplines really they're just like different paths and they're both totally legitimate.
Oh, well, so, not in science. They hate each other. They're like, screw you. I do it the right way. So it's different, but,
well, they
I feel
also
like
need
improv,
to learn
they at least want a hug. So it's okay.
Yes. We're better. Improv, better than scientists. Take
legitimately,
that
improv is like helping scientists. I don't know if you know this, but Alan Alda is legitimately teaching
I was just about
scientists
to say his name.
How to do improv up in upstate mm-hmm. New York because it's making their lives better. Just saying.
No, totally. Improv makes everyone's lives better. Lives better. So.
Sure.
So at that point, I started to drift further away from improv because that's the improv community that was there. So I found myself in college just like find that in college is when I found the Viewpoints book and I turned to people and I was like, can we just do this? Could we just like do this, all the, because it just lays the things out in order for you. And I just like blind led the viewpoints workshop, just sort of like following Bogart's descriptions of what to do. It wasn't super fruitful, but I like, in terms of making devised movement theater or whatever is the goal there. But I learned a lot as I did it. Well, I did other things there as I was like sort of exploring different things that I now look back and I'm like, oh, I made a radio play, or I took a story of Sherlock Holmes and we turned it into a radio play, which I'm now making podcast stories in the similar sort of way. So like I was exploring all these different things, because the core thing that was feeding me, which this was like this world of like, we improvise, we make things, and then eventually we tell them as a story, wasn't happening as much as I like was doing more traditional looking theater stuff. Like the theater stuff was like, we're going to learn this play and do it for your practicum. And you're going to learn all this theater history stuff. Stuff that's like more sort of normal university theater studies, if that makes sense. And so I was just sort of thinking like, okay, this is where I'm going. Like I'm going to go find out what it's to be like a director or a dramaturg or a deviser in the world of theater. And that's how I leave college, going into just like, I'm just going to find theaters and sort of beg them to find work for me. And so I did like a year and a half of just like showing up to theaters. There was one guy I knew who had been connected to the college. So I just like showed up and was like, can I be your assistant director? He was like, you can be my assistant stage manager and assistant director. Everyone had technical work for me. So I did a lot of always, there's always need for it. So I did a lot of like setting up lights, setting up sounds, building sets, running spotlights, like all these things that just gave me access. Because mm-hmm. I was just so curious what it actually looked like to do, to make these things, which I had been sort of studying and learning about in school. And that was where we were speaking a little bit about this earlier. I started to notice this, like the incredible amount of hustle required. Like mm-hmm. I know everyone's hustling all the time, but it seemed like a lot. It seemed like people were like working in the morning at one place and at night at another, and like late into the night and then early in the morning, and just working incredibly hard, to their credit, being just so strong. And just like, I met a lot of people who had really great partnerships, and I started to really appreciate when people would have like a partnership that they were supporting each other, not romantic partners, but like working partners. Like there was this, I worked for as a stage manager, but then I got to know like, this, Elena DeMonaco and her partner Hagen Walker Bryce. Oh, I'm forgetting if their name is the middle name. Anyway, they had this wonderful collaboration, creating incredible plays together very quickly with incredibly diverse groups of artists. I ran into another couple of people who had come out of the ART, who were sort of like, they had synced up on their ideas of creating and they were supporting each other. And I was like, oh, that's the world I like. These two people who are making brand new work, right? As I like sort of had studied all these different levels of what theater looked like. So after like setting up a lot of speakers for a while, I sort of settled on like, okay, I'm going to go to this program with the eye on finding a collaborator, right? That was how that whole arc sort of ended. After spending all this time with all these people, it's like, I'm going to go get an MFA, find a collaborator and settle in. But then of course, as you know, that program didn't happen. So, anyway, things change. You make plans.
I know. I myself have often looked for collaborators, you know, people that I could connect with and do projects with. And, you know, I've worked with people project to project, and there have been people who have, you know, done a lot of projects with me, but I don't know that anybody is necessarily my like creative partner. I mean, perhaps my husband, in the way that both of us create podcasts and support each other, and you know, with his music and my art, we're very supportive of each other, but we don't create it together. And you know, like, I don't know, I've seen that a lot, and I've also like wished for a person to be my my partner, but I don't know. I've never found that person. And so I guess I choose to go back to my idea of like, well, it's not just one thing. It's not, you know, this isn't the only way that it works. It looks like it works well for them, but maybe that's not the way it works for you. And like, so I just start projects myself. Like I just, if I want to do something, I just do it. And if I, and then I get people to help me. Like I don't create things with other people. It's like I create enough of a whole thing that I can be like, okay, this is what I need your help for. And like, don't get me wrong, I did a sketch show for 8 years and I didn't write all of it at all. Like I definitely had a whole staff that was writing the whole thing, but it was like, it was still my project. And I was still the single person that stayed for all 8 years, as opposed to like the in and out of writers and actors and stuff like that. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would like that. That would be nice. I don't know if that's a, like you get it once in your lifetime, or if it's like maybe that's just not how I work, and like I'm looking at something and being like, oh, if only. But really, like if I did it, I'd be like, oh God, why? This is not for me. I don't know.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. I think I had started. I don't think it was as strong as sort of like a fetishization. I was maybe sort of imagining this ideal thing that would happen, which is not super helpful to do as a creative person, to say when I have this condition, then everything's going to be great. Because if you do that, you'll sit around and not make anything, right? You have to just start. You have to just begin, whether or not you have this sort of perfect image that you've created, whether or not you've acquired that setup, or that situation or that relationship, you just have to start making stuff regardless. Yeah. And so at some point I did that. I decided I'm done waiting and I'm just gonna, the podcast I make now, I did end up needing a collaborator, and I found somebody who, I don't know that I would have turned to Caesar and been like, Caesar, you're going to be my artistic partner. But he was the right person, the right time. We're linked up on it. We're synced up and agreed, and we're making stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think there's lots of different ways into projects. And I had just at some point decided that I was just going to sort of like googly eyed admire these couple of creative partnerships. And maybe I'll find one of those someday. I wouldn't be opposed to it. But I think you're right in that it's better to just start than it is to wait for, I need everything perfectly aligned before I can begin. Because then you will not begin and you'll feel bad for not beginning.
There's literally nothing that's perfectly aligned ever, except for things in your brain. Like it's not even real. Like even constellations change regularly. Like
that's true.
They're just not even all there in the same. And they're like, oh, look at that group of stars. You're like, no, 2-3 days ago it was in a different spot. Like what? No.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like everything moves. So you got to move with it, I guess.
Everything moves. I think about that a lot. Like if there was a lesson of the universe, if you look around, it is constant change, right? Everything is growing, dying, entropically decaying, or building itself back up in opposition to that. Everything is in constant revolution and adjustment. So there is no, there's no lesson of like, when things arrive at sort of perfect balance, that's when things can really begin. And we're all sort of sort of chaotically tumbling down the hill. Yeah, go on.
I feel like you're like we're all decaying pieces of flesh, and you know, it's like no. Like the world is in chaos. Yes, the world is constantly changing, but in our tiny moments, like we're stardust. We're you know, wild. We're wild tiny dots on this little, you know, like ball in the sky, whatever. But the other thing
this is a John
that's
Green novel?
Interesting and cool is the idea of like have you ever, you know, we are water, and the and the moon affects the water, and the moon creates the tides, and we are water, which means there's a tide in us, and that is moved every day. And the idea of this like ebb and flow within yourself that you're not in control of, there's this energy source that's moving it around, and whatever way the water's in your body moving around, you know, like that's how that's why it's like some days you're an extrovert and some days you're an introvert and some days you're like a, you know, dictator and some days you're like a teddy bear, you know, like it's just different. Mm-hmm. You can be everything, because you will be all the time.
Yeah, totally. We'll be all the time. And I you are very deep. Wonderful. Wonderfully said. And I would add just this, that in the chaos of all of this and in our ebb and flow, which sort of just happens to us, we can in various moments build structures from person to person or within communities, which have meaning that sort of transcends our individual little chaotic bubbles, that provides some structure or creates some story, creates culture, really. And the fact that we like doing that is a pretty pretty good indication that we should do it because it makes us feel good to have built some little walls and things that resist the endless decay of the world around us. And that's a good thing. And we should keep doing it and keep buying into it.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. There's something wonderful about, you know, embracing your own life and enjoying the creativity as it washes over you and letting, you know, accepting the ideas that are happening to you right now as sort of, you know, unique to your personal perspective, because in a few years, who knows what will change that will change the way you look at something. Or, I mean, I have stories that I have where it was like, I wrote it and then it was like, I don't know. And I put it away. And like 6 years later, I come back to it and finally it makes sense. You know what I mean? Like in ways that the beauty of us creating stuff is that sometimes we create something and it really represents this moment in time. This like, oh, remember when you did that? You know, like different groups that you're a part of, even like, you know, your high school improv thing is different than the plays you were writing in China. You know what I mean? But you still had the same creative impetus to tell stories and develop stuff. But it came out differently because of all of the varying conditions that changed that moment. But you're still you. You're like you said, we have this impetus to tell stories, like let it out, do that. If you feel it, you should do it because, you know, I think all of our brains do it. It's just some people make it into stories to be like, hey, everybody, look. And some people just do it in their own head.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And also to add to that thing you were saying about the conditions, I mean, I think this year has shown everyone that we have to be really cognizant of the way our conditions affect us, right? We have all been forced to look at, it's harder for me to create when I don't meet people in person. Cool, I've learned something about myself. And I was definitely going through that a bit in China, which is, it was kind of disorienting being there because it's a very different sort of culture that it takes a long time to get to know. And as you might have been able to guess from my story leading into it, I didn't just like spend a bunch of time learning Chinese before I went. I didn't know. I didn't consult someone who is a deep, you know, not a deep knowledge about Chinese culture. I just showed up there and was very much adrift in a place that I didn't recognize, hanging out with a sort of subculture of my culture that was this expat group, which is this combination of people from all over the United States. We share things in the sort of broadest sense, but something about it didn't feed me in the same way. And I was recognizing like, okay, I need to find the improv community within this space. And then I'll start to be fed by that because we have a shared culture, a shared understanding that maybe I don't have with, like, I'm making air quotes, American culture at large, because I don't even really know that that exists. But so I had to find this group that I... well...
I literally only know because people from other countries tell me. Like, it's not even us that we can't know it. It's not for us to know. It's for us to be told as a reflection of us.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, so we'll never be aware. I've learned more about my own culture from meeting improvisers in other countries and talking to them about it than I ever did just sort of, because you're right. I mean, the United States is a humongous place with 1,000 places. There are different cultures all over the place. There are different vibes, like you know, even Boston to Philly to Austin, where I am right now, these places are all very different, you know? Even in your state alone, Philly to Pittsburgh, the vibe is different. It's a different kind of scene, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like a different thing. And even close by DC, there's another super like specific thing there, you know? So you're right that city to city, there's a lot of stuff, but it's not about what it actually is. It's about how it's perceived and how it will be told in stories. That is the quote unquote truth.
Totally.
I both liked what I said and then felt bad about it. Like, I was like, oh, I feel so correct, but I also kind of hate that.
Because you want there to be an objective truth? Is that the part of it that made you sort of like, oh?
Yeah. And the idea that, like, almost, I heard this thing recently that, like, people who, when you think of yourself, you have a very specific idea of who you are, but you don't know yourself as well as other people know you, because other people see you for what you really are and not for what you think you are in your head.
And yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
I get what you're saying. And I think that makes a certain sense. There's another way of thinking about it that I've been sort of wrapping my head around. It's been on a bit of a hold recently, but I was trying to read some Kierkegaard with a group of friends. And Kierkegaard has this idea of that we're sort of a dual being. Like we sort of have a self that is in relationship with a perception of itself. And the self is the thing that exists between those two things, like us and the thing that knows us as who we are, then is what we sort of present to other people. And that comes out like the way we relate to ourselves is the way we relate to others. Right. So the thing that people see about us, you know, they might think I think there can still be a deeper unknown part of us that is maybe not coming out because we don't know how to like properly love and accept ourselves. So we can't really show what we feel like we are to the world, if that makes sense. Like, I think there's a bit of a trap in saying that everyone else is seeing me totally accurately because I don't think I
not accurately, okay. Just sort of like in wider screen. Like right. I'm looking at myself through a fisheye lens and they are seeing me on a big movie screen.
Yeah. Like they see the result, right? They see the way you exist in the world in a way that you can't. Yeah. I think that's fair to say. Yeah. And I've just been toying with this idea a lot about really that we are sort of, there's our perception, which is in relationship with ourself, right? We have sort of our being is this sort of like dual thing that is then the relationship of those two things is what ends up being presented to the world, which I think a lot of what I strive, what I get out of performing or out of improv is that I get a little bit more of that chipped away, or I understand it more, especially as I can like reflect on what I did. I can start to recognize, oh, I made that choice because I have this impulse. I can start to understand this like being that is myself a little bit more by like reflecting on the choices that I make in improv, because there's less at stake than sort of going like, well, why did I take that job? Well, because I needed not to starve. So that's why I kept doing that. Or, you know, like, whereas in improv, I can reflect on them all. It's like, oh, I wanted this or I wanted this. It helps me do this work of like knowing and understanding this like other part of myself so that I can, I don't know, more genuinely interact with the world, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's a little vague.
No, we went down a super intense, like, philosophical rabbit hole. And, like, there's a part of me that wants us to go down so much deeper. And then I was like, hold on. I'm looking at the time.
What time is it?
I'm looking at the time. And what I'm going to do is, instead of continue down the philosophical rabbit hole, you're welcome, audience, I am going to ask you my last question, which is going to be, I think we talked about it a little, but what's the project that's like your jam right now? Like, what's the thing that's making you fulfilled? Is it your podcast? Is it your podcast and something else? Is it something else that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I'll say two things, because the podcast is totally steadily continuing to come together and is a great joy to work on and keep perfecting. So I have this podcast called The Offer, which started as do you know Off Book, the improvised musical podcast? Do you know them?
Anyway, I think
you should.
So.
They're great. They're wonderful. And I was listening to that, and I was listening to some other sort of improvised audio stories about a year ago, slightly before the pandemic sort of locked the whole world down. And I had this idea to create improvised audio stories, sort of modifying a Herald form, right? So I sort of took some ideas and tweaked them to make them work with sort of some ideas of like a well-told story, and created like a long form. And so once a week we release a long form audio story. It's usually myself, my co-host Caesar, and a guest. A lot of our guests have come from the Zmac network, which is, we know a lot of people who are in Shanghai and Bangkok, and we're also broadening out to welcome other people in. And it's really just a lot of fun. And I think we found a cool way to tell an audio story. And it is really fulfilling to work on. The other thing I started doing is I took a series of workshops with a wonderful institute in Philadelphia called Pig Iron. And with some people in those workshops, Pig Iron's a devising theater thing. I don't know a company, I guess. They're a theater company. That's the right word. And I took a workshop with them that was sort of their first attempt at trying an online version of their intensive, which they call Something from Nothing. And it was really wonderful, really satisfying. And the group that I was working on that with has continued to meet, you know, once every couple of weeks and just play it with the tools that we learned in that class to try and create things. Whether or not those things will become theater pieces that we make, what is great about it is it has that spirit of, we're just meeting to jam and play in this sort of very physical, nonverbal way. Because the offer is a very verbal play, right? It's a lot of word talking, which is very satisfying. But the thing that is really great about this other thing I've been doing is finding this play in the body, which has been really fulfilling to be doing as well. Yeah.
That's really great. I'm glad that you're able to find physical theater even when you're doing it on Zoom. Like, you know, there's a lot to be said for the sort of like sitting in a chair improv that a lot of people are doing. And so it's great that you're able to find physicality in the experience.
It's been really cool. And I don't know if it's physical theater. It might just be physical playtime, but that is important to find because I've definitely been lacking that. I do a lot of sitting and, you know, talking into microphones and just getting up and like flailing around a room in a series of rules feels really good. Yeah. And I hope soon to be doing it in rooms with people again. But until then, I can have fun on Zoom. So I've been trying. Yeah.
That's so great. Oh, man. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with me.
I appreciate you, Amy, because I really think at the core of all these creative pursuits is that there's something really good about creating things. Humans like to create. It's really satisfying to do it. And I hope everyone who's listening, start making stuff. Just do it. Whatever you want to make. You're right to want to make it and do it. So thank you, Amy, for making this thing to encourage people to create. It's really cool.
Oh, thanks. That's so nice of you.
No, you have a cool project here.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.